Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bridget Bergen from WNYC's newsroom. My friend Brian is taking a little break today, but he wanted me to let you know that a couple of weeks ago, he hosted a special program that asked, what will abortion access look like after Roe is overturned, as it's likely to be? He wanted to keep our sights set on the fact that abortions will continue whether or not it's a constitutionally protected right, and also that we've been here before. In the time before Roe, there were networks of people, often clergy, as you'll hear, who helped women travel and secure abortions out of state. And the guiding question is, we can't go back to before Roe, so where are we going? So here's Brian's End of Roe National Call-In Special in its entirety.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Friday, May 27th. With me are Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for The 19th, a news organization focusing on gender, politics, and policy. If you don't know The 19th, it was founded in 2020 to coincide with the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in this country, of course. The full name of the site is The 19th with an asterisk to acknowledge that at first the vote really only went to white women. Erin was previously with the Associated Press as national writer on race and ethnicity. Jessica Bruder is with us, too. She's probably best known as the author of Nomadland, her book that was the basis of the movie that won the Best Picture Oscar last year. She's now the author of a sweeping article in the May issue of The Atlantic on the past, present, and yes, the future of abortion in America. The article is called The Abortion Underground. Jessica and Erin, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
Thank you.
And listeners, just to be really clear, as we open the phones to invite you to help us report this story, this is not a debate tonight on abortion rights pro and con. Whatever your opinion is, that's your opinion and that's your right. But that's for another show, no matter what side you're on. For this hour, we're describing a condition that exists and that will exist even more if Roe is overturned, the legal abortion interstate network. So here's our invitation to you. Maybe you're part of an abortion underground already today, serving women in states where abortion is already mostly unavailable. We're inviting you right now to call in and tell us a story of how you do that and of someone you helped. Or maybe you're a woman who has been helped by this modern underground with telehealth prescriptions or transportation out of state or whatever. On either side of that helped and helper network, we're inviting you to tell us your story. So, Jessica, as calls are coming in, let's start with the era just before Roe, the 1960s and early 70s. You write in your Atlantic article that a group called the Clergy Consultation Service, around 1,400 mainly Protestant ministers, but also including rabbis and Catholic priests, connected countless women with abortion providers. How and where did those clergy members do that work?
Oh, they did it all over the place. It was absolutely fascinating to me because I've always thought of abortion as something that fell largely along religious lines. But, this group brought together all sorts of faith leaders. It was mostly Protestant ministers, but it was also rabbis and Catholic priests, and they were intermediaries connecting women with abortion providers. And I do remember reading a bit about somebody who was in the faith community, one of the ministers who was initially reticent, and another leader said, if you could just sit with these people and see what they're going through, I think you would come to understand that this could be part of your ministry. And so that group grew. It blew my mind that that group grew to about 1,400 people at least and connected women with safe care.
Should people be surprised to hear that a network of clergy members was involved with facilitating abortion access when we think of the anti-abortion rights movement as largely grounded in religion today?
I don't think so at all. I don't think it's surprising. I think that there have been many ideas about the abortion debate that have calcified and tended to lose nuance over time as well. Also the idea, for example, that all underground abortions were dangerous and killed people, which I know that people who are in favor of easing abortion access today are very concerned that that may dissuade people from getting care if they have to do it in an unconventional way. When in truth, throughout history, there have been midwives and traditional healers, there have been sympathetic doctors. It hasn't always been either the coat hanger or the clinic. So I think in my mind, the clergy consultation service is another one of these details and stories that kind of puts the lie to the idea that things were really simply one way or another. Mm.
So interesting for people who didn't live through that era. Erin, could you talk about the reality of abortion access in this country today? Roe versus Wade hasn't been overturned yet, but within the framework of Roe and the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision that reaffirmed Roe in 1992, abortion access, as you know, has been shrinking in many states. Could you talk about how and where, roughly?
Yeah, so at the 19th, we have been reporting extensively on kind of what that abortion network, what that landscape really looks like, and the idea that it is shrinking. You know, as it stands today, you do have... you know, even as you have a decreased accessibility to abortion access, it is important to remind people that this draft leaked opinion does not mean that abortion is no longer legal as we sit here today, right? Like abortion is still legal until, you know, the eventual final opinion on Dobbs versus Women's Health is issued, right?
Legal, so, but extremely restricted in a lot of places, such as the case from Jackson, Mississippi. That's the only abortion clinic in the state, right?
Yes, exactly. And my colleague, Shefali Luthra, who has been doing so much of our reporting on abortion access, wrote a story that I would direct people to about the situation in Kansas, for example, where that state is wondering what the future is going to look like as Kansas has been a place where people could come and have abortion access from, for example, from neighboring states, but not sure what the future of that is going to look like as you have 13 states that have already passed trigger bans that would outlaw abortion as soon as Roe is overturned, but you still have about a dozen states with laws in place to protect abortion as we sit here today.
Let's take our first phone call. Here's David in Houston. David, you're on the program. Thank you so much for calling in.
All right. I'd like to say thanks and let you know a little about the position of an Afghan refugee family who's resettled here in Houston. The family is a lovely couple with eight children. And when she got here to Houston, they were settled successfully. And unfortunately, the birth control pills that she got here were not effective for her. And she is now expecting her ninth child. They really don't have the means of support for the eight that they have. And we'll be flying next week at the family's request to help her get an abortion out of state.
May I ask what state you're going to?
Be headed to Chicago, Illinois.
And how did it come about that you looked around and you couldn't get an abortion for this woman, even with Roe versus Wade still on the books in your home state of Texas there?
Right. She's at 8 weeks currently. And there are no other options. Mail order pharmacies take too long. And even going to a closer nearby state to drive, there's a 24-hour wait period. And the most convenient and expeditious and safe method for her is to travel by air up to Chicago.
David, thank you for your call. And Erin, I'll go right back to you on this. I'll bet it's shocking for some of our listeners to even hear a story like that. Maybe that's the first time they ever heard a story like that of a refugee twice over I might call her, first from Afghanistan, and now what's coming to be known as an abortion refugee in this country.
Yes, and also a mother, you know, who is making making this choice about, you know, her family planning. So, you know, I think, you know, in the last 2 weeks, as this draft opinion, the news of this draft opinion has come out, the reality of the potential of a post-Roe world is beginning to sink in, right? For 36 million women and a lot of their allies who are kind of bracing for what that is going to mean, the reality that people could potentially have to travel hundreds of miles for abortion access, you know, depending on what happens at the state level after this Dobbs decision comes down, if it comes down the way that it is expected to, based again on that draft opinion that was leaked. And so, you know, you have people that are also contemplating the future of medicated abortions, as Jessica had mentioned.
And let's go to another caller, Donna in Cromwell, Connecticut. Hi, Donna, you're on the program. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call. I am one of the women that was helped to obtain an abortion through the clergy. I never met these people, and honestly, I cannot remember how I got the information. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But
it was before Roe.
Before Roe. I'm 76 years old, so. Yeah, before Roe. And I never met these people. They would just contact me by phone. They gave me the address of a physician in New York, and I went to see her, and, you know, it's history.
Where were you living at the time?
Stamford, Connecticut.
Ah, so even there was a difference even between Connecticut and New York at that time. That's so interesting. Donna, thank you for sharing a little bit of your story. And Jessica, there you go. You could start writing a sequel.
Wow, that was incredible. I could talk to her for 20 more minutes, which we don't have. But it's incredible just to hear her look back to that and to think about what changes that may or may not have created in her own life. It might be a good moment to bring up something called the Turnaway Study. There's an amazing study by Dr. Diana Green Foster. She spent a decade looking at what happened when women who were seeking abortions but turned away, what happened to them afterwards. And we know that people who wanted to get them but couldn't experienced higher rates of poverty, needed to rely on more public assistance. Many women, just when you look at the outcomes for the children, for the other children in the families as well, we know today more than half of women who have abortions already have children. So it's just interesting to hear somebody thinking about it and reflecting backwards down the line and wondering what an impact that might have had on her life.
Yeah. Erin, could you talk about how much of a disparate impact you think these laws and policies of recent years have had by race and class in America and in anticipation disparities after Roe?
Absolutely. So we know that this is absolutely an issue that is divided by race as well as gender. We know that women of color are the ones who are the ones mainly availing themselves of abortion access and who will be the main ones impacted by abortion access. Women of color and also poor women, women across the South, especially as we see a lot of these trigger laws being passed and a lot of these laws that are restricting access or limiting the time that someone has to access abortion care. And so that is absolutely something that I'm hearing from organizers that I'm talking to, especially Black women organizers across the South who are very concerned about what a post-Roe future looks like for Black women who already are disproportionately impacted in terms of maternal mortality as well. And so, you know, for Black women, the abortion access is more fragile, and also the risk of carrying a child to term is very real and absolutely more dangerous for them in this country.
And yet the stats I keep seeing are that roughly Black women are about 13% of the female population in the U.S., but get around 40% of the abortions.
That's correct.
The Kaiser Family Foundation says 38%, so in that range. White women, 30% of the abortions, way less than their percentage in the population. Latinas, 21%, close to their representation. Do you have any report? Well, it sounds like you've already kind of affirmed that you think that's accurate. But why are the rates roughly what they are then by race?
Well, it's not only a function of race, right? I mean, again, we are talking about also issues of class, just issues of life circumstances for a lot of these women who are making choices based on those circumstances in a lot of cases. And so, as well as, like I said, the disproportionate health disparity and maternal mortality issue that plays into Black women's health when they are pregnant. So there are a number of factors. It is not certainly, something as sinister as Black and brown women having a proclivity to want to get abortion. That is not the case at all. It is a number of factors, that disproportionately impact these women along lines of race and gender that are contributing to those numbers.
Let's hear another person's story. Christy in the greater Washington, D.C. area. You're on the program. Hi, Christy. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me, and thanks for having this really important conversation.
Sure. You're a certified nurse midwife, I see.
Yes, and a sexual and reproductive health nurse practitioner.
And how are you related to the issue in your work?
Yeah, I wear a lot of different hats that are all related mostly to telehealth abortion. So I have a private practice for midwifery that's serving 6 states. I also work with Aid Access, which is an international organization that offers telehealth medication abortions in all 50 states in the United States. And I work with Plan C Pills, which is an informational campaign that puts info out for folks on how they can access abortion pills online, also in all 50 states. And then I do volunteer for the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, which is a hotline of licensed clinicians answering medical questions for folks who are going through a miscarriage or abortion at home.
And I'm curious if you and that network that you work with are gearing up for the likely post-Roe world when all those trigger laws take effect in a whole bunch of states, and ramping up your helping with the access to the pills?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've already seen a huge increase in numbers just from when the drafted decision was leaked last week. So for example, Aid Access website traffic increased nearly 3,000% from Monday to Tuesday. And in the first week of May, so from when the leak happened through just yesterday, we've already fully processed 16% of the total number of clients that we saw for the entire year last year. So we're really seeing an increase in demand. And we're uniquely poised because of the fact that we have both clinicians in the United States as well as Dr. Rebecca Gompertz is based out of Austria. And so she is able to prescribe into states that have state level restrictions. So even after this decision becomes finalized, we're going to continue to offer care in all 50 states.
Wow. Tell me what happened again between the Monday last week when the leak of the draft decision came out and Tuesday. What was that stat you gave me?
Yeah, so the first one was that our website traffic, so just people clicking on the website, increased it was just under 3,000%. And then in the terms of the total number of clients that we've served. So we review their consultation forms. We make sure we have all of their information, approve it, write a prescription that gets sent off to a mail order pharmacy. So we fully completed that process for 16% of the entire number of people from last year in 1 week.
Wow. Thank you for reporting that. That's so informative, and I really appreciate it. Christy, yeah, in the greater D.C. area. Jessica, in a way, and there's another eye-popping story, right? But in a way, the heart of your article is about the medications that pregnant people can use in their own homes, no refugee status needed, yes?
Absolutely. And as I was finishing the article, I actually went and ordered pills myself from Aid Access, because another thing that they do that other people can't do, or so far, and again, I hope somebody will correct me on this if it's not accurate. So far, the only telehealth provider I have encountered is Aid Access that offers something called advance provision. And that means that somebody can order pills for potential use in the future. It's kind of the object to have under glass to break with a hammer in case needed. And as somebody who is not a pregnant person, I was able to go online and order the pills and have them delivered. I answered a questionnaire. It was not very invasive. It did not take very long, and they showed up pretty quickly. I should also disclose, though, I was in California, where there are really no barriers to accessing the pills by telehealth, and they actually came from a telehealth provider that was maybe 7 miles away, just the actual pharmacy that filled it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Brian, if I can just chime in here, I mean, what Jessica is saying, the situation could not be more different in Oklahoma, where we have a story out of today. You know, you just had that clinician telling her story on the ground out of DC. We talked to Andrea Gallegos, who was canceling patients' appointments the day after the Supreme Court leak, and was able to add a few more back on the schedule, you know, after, you know, the Tuesday after that, because the governor hadn't signed the bill yet. But by the time, you know, Oklahoma was moving, you know, Gallego starts calling back patients who were 6 weeks pregnant, already diverting them to other states like Kansas or New Mexico or maybe even Colorado. You know, this is what clinicians are trying to do. They're trying to come up with strategies to help their patients get to neighboring clinics, but there are limits to what they can do. And that reality is really starting to sink in places like Oklahoma and places like Texas, Mississippi, where folks are really scrambling to figure out what their options are.
And
can I piggyback on Erin for a second?
Please, go ahead, Jessica. Go.
To Erin's point, just thinking of the impact of SB 8, which was that ban essentially on abortions after 6 weeks. When that happened in Texas, for many people, providers, activists, it looked like a dress rehearsal for the end of Roe. That's when people started using this term abortion refugees, because 1 in 10 women of reproductive age in the whole United States, they live in Texas. So the effect was immediate and seismic. States next door were bottlenecked. There was just a swell of people pushing outwards. The bottlenecks were pretty serious. And when you think about it, very complicated, because if somebody is in the first trimester of pregnancy and perhaps can get a simple procedure or pills, and then they have to wait and go further along, procedure gets more complicated and more often prohibitively expensive. We saw states as far as Maryland and Washington state seeing an uptick in Texas patients. We saw people in states adjacent to Texas who couldn't get care in their own states. So that great scrambling, and we also know of people who got stuck in Texas, right? Because there's a tremendous resource gap. So if we look at that seismic diaspora and think about what could happen were 26 states to end up banning it. I know we have trigger laws in 13, but there is an estimate that more than half of states could end up banning the procedure. It's an incredible reshuffling, and one that people should realize will impact states where abortion is welcome and legal, not just states where it is forbidden.
Yeah.
Here's another pre-Roe story coming from Judy in Larchmont, New York. Judy, you're on the program. Thank you so much for calling
in. Thank you. I'm a fan of yours, Brian. Listen to you almost every day. Thanks for this great program tonight. I was a young woman, college graduate, living in Ohio and working for the public health department in the city where I lived. And I worked for a special program for maternity and infant care that existed in the 60s and 70s. I had no idea if it still exists. I no longer live over there. But at the time, we had deliveries of about 2,000 medically indigent patients every year at the major hospital there. And 1/4 of those women had never seen a doctor even one time before they delivered. And our job was to try to improve that statistic. When I left and left the state and moved to New York, we had reduced that to 5% of no prenatal care by, you know, helping them with every problems getting to the clinic, the maternity clinic, and so on, and giving them babysitting money. We did everything we could to make them have help them have healthy babies. And one of the things we did, we had a psychiatrist on our staff, and we had social workers and nutritionists. And in the discussion with patients, sometimes we would come across patients who really felt that they could not have a baby for whatever reason. And sometimes it was psychological, that they thought their life would end if this happened to them, and whatever. But it was discussed among the professionals. And if it was decided that a woman was eligible under medical standards for an abortion, she couldn't get it in Ohio at that time. I don't remember the law. It's mm-hmm. been such a long time now. Mm-hmm. But what our program did was arrange for these women to go on a Greyhound bus to New York. And we set them up, and I knew I wasn't involved in the details, but I was an administrator there in the program. And I remember, because as a young woman, it made a big impression on me that, gee, this is what they have to do, you know, when it's been medically shown that they really need this procedure, but they couldn't get it there. And I can't believe that we're going back to those dark ages again. Just awfully awful.
Judy, thank you very much for your call and sharing your experience. And yeah, Aaron, before Roe, there was a patchwork of states, some of which had legal abortion. New York did legalize it before Roe versus Wade. I don't know Ohio's history, but judging from that call, Ohio had not. So there was a patchwork.
Yeah. And you know, Brian, we are hearing so many stories from people just like Judy across the country who are talking about what life was like before Roe. You know, in a way, you have a generation of people who lived through that era and may be folks who are weighing in on how to navigate what happens after this Dobbs decision. We talked to several people who described life before Roe, sharing their stories, which we so appreciated, talking about getting procedures in a world before Roe, people who, you know, even, you know, were pro-life, but had to make that choice, you know, describing what that was like, saying things like, I will for my whole life never forget it. It traumatized me. You know, women in their 20s.
In addition to abortion refugees, Jessica, before we go to our next caller, are we about to see abortion fugitives? There was just a story last month of a 26-year-old woman in Texas named Lizelle Herrera, who was indicted on murder charges for what I've seen reported as the death of an individual by self-induced abortion. That was the charge. And that indictment has been dropped, I see. But is that the post-Roe future, too?
Well, it's not only the post-Roe future, it is the present and a bit the past. But yes, I do think there's a lot concern, not only concern about criminalization, but just overzealous prosecution and overzealous law enforcement, particularly on communities that are traditionally overpoliced. We can go back to, again, communities of color and low-income communities. In the case of Lizelle Herrera, there was no charge that would stick, and yet that did not stop police from dragging this poor person through the mud. And this kind of stuff has happened before. There's a case we know in 2017, a woman named Latisse Fisher, her husband called 911 to report a stillbirth. She was later charged with second-degree murder because her cell phone data revealed an internet search for abortion pills. We know Purvi Patel, 2 years earlier, was convicted of feticide and child neglect after taking abortion pills. Used against her for evidence was a text message that was unencrypted with a friend of hers describing the search for medication abortion online. We know the story of Jennifer Whalen in Pennsylvania, who procured pills for her 16-year-old daughter. And when the daughter got scared during the miscarriage because of the bleeding and the pains, they went to the hospital and disclosed that she'd had the pills. And the daughter was fine. The mother ended up in jail for providing them.
And Erin, to that point, it looks like there may well be some constitutional battles between legal and illegal states coming up, like about extradition. If a patient or a provider from an illegal state like Texas is involved in an abortion in a legal state like New York or California. Here's a clip of Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik from New York taking aim at her own state leadership as it sets aside money to help women coming to New York as abortion refugees to exercise their abortion rights there. Listen.
So the fact that New York is trying to sell itself as an abortion on demand state is outrageous. And it really concerns me that you have Democratic leaders who are advocating for murdering of babies.
So she's going all the way there with that language. And that's Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of upstate New York. Under the Texas law, which offers cash rewards for turning in people involved with abortions, Erin, could she call up a Texas law enforcement agency and profit from blowing the whistle on somebody coming, let's say, to a Planned Parenthood clinic in Brooklyn?
It's an open question that certain Republicans certainly seem willing to challenge, right, Brian? But I think, you know, what's important about what you're bringing up is the psychological impact of this decision and what it could mean, you know, the idea that everything is on the table for women who are concerned about what this decision is going to mean, especially as conservative-led states could be emboldened to further restrict access to abortion, the idea that that could discourage patients from seeking abortion that under current law they are constitutionally entitled to, right, but don't know what that's going to mean going forward. So the education that you see happening now among advocates, the fear and anxiety that you've seen in the last 2 weeks as people begin to contemplate what this could mean comes from scenarios just like what the representative laid out there.
Let's take another caller with a story. Frankie in Pennsylvania, you're on the program. Frankie, thank you for calling in.
Oh, thank you for this incredibly wonderful program. I'm 70 now, and in 1971, my friend and her boyfriend decided to have an abortion. And we went to New York City, and everything turned out just the way we all wanted. And it was interesting though. I think it was $300. That's another thing that we need to talk about. We got there, but we had the money. My friend and her boyfriend ended up, you know, asking for loans and whatnot from all friends and such, and they raised the money, but it was no easy thing. But I also wanted to say that, you know, those two, my friend and her boyfriend, got married and have had two sons and are now grandparents. So I think it's really important to know that there's people from all socioeconomic levels, women from all socioeconomic levels that need abortions for whatever their own reason is. And it doesn't just... Okay.
Right. This doesn't mean that they don't ever want to have children. I hear what you're saying.
Exactly. And I just wanted to say one more thing, if I may.
Please.
I believe in all my years, I'm a registered nurse, and I worked 40-some years in medicine, and I believe that the issue of abortion and restricting abortion is all about power against p- people in power want to control women. Control. It's about power and control. That's the issue, in my opinion.
Frankie, thank you very much for your call and your story. We're getting so many pre-Roe stories. Wow. So many of our listeners who weren't even born then, I'm sure you've never heard these stories. Bill in Tallahassee, as we go from Frankie in Pennsylvania to Bill in Tallahassee, Florida. Bill, you're on the program. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind or make people think about what I knew when I was young. I'm 75 right now. In the late 1960s, abortions were illegal in New York. Illegal. But there were doctors that would perform them. We'd get women. I worked with a group of people. I originally worked with Daytop as an aide with people that were relatives of drug addicts, of heroin addicts. And I connected
right, that's
up with
a,
people.
Drug that rehab organization in New York, Daytop or Daytop Village,
originally it was a
right?
drug rehab based on Synanon, on the Alcoholics Anonymous and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And I worked for them in 1966, 67, 68. And I became aware of the problem of younger women and women, poor women, having to need abortions that were safe instead of, because a lot of people ended up in illegal clinics that were very dangerous and that didn't keep sanitary codes and things like that. So a group of people used to contribute money. I used to give rides and take people and accompany women to their appointments. And that's what it was like. But there were abortions where there were botched abortions all the time back then. Mm-hmm. Also, in 1970, I'd met my wife. I just met her about a month before, 2 months before, and she got pregnant. I told her that whatever she wanted to do would be fine with me. At that point, she decided to have an abortion, which made me really happy. It was the first week of legal abortions in New York State.
Wow.
She had it at Roosevelt Hospital on, I guess it was 57th Street over on the west side when Roosevelt Hospital was there.
So your wife had one of the first legal abortions in New York State.
The first week. I think it was the second day. It could have been the first day. I'm not sure. I can't remember that, but it was the first week for sure. And she was in a room with, I would say, about 15 or 20 beds of all women that were having abortions that week. I was the only male in that room.
Do you remember any of the feeling at that time of the newness of the legalization in New York, an emotion that went with that or a thought that went with that because it was so, so new?
Now I have people that I like that like Trump, although obviously I disagree with him 100%. Yeah,
you live in Tallahassee, you'll find one or two. Go ahead.
No, I live in New York and Tallahassee.
Okay.
I've been coming to Tallahassee for the winter because I had a wonderful experience in Tallahassee when I was going to go from Gainesville to the San Francisco Art Institute in 69. I went to a party in Tallahassee that a girlfriend of mine had, and I saw mixtures of blacks and white professors where in New York, there might be two or three blacks in a group of 20. There would be 5 to 10 blacks here in a group of 20, 25 teachers and stuff like that. So about 5 years ago, I decided to make a stop, and I found some wonderful things and some very stupid things here, too.
Bill, thank you very much for your call and sharing that story with us that goes back even earlier than the other ones, because New York was the refugee state in the earlier callers, and he goes back to even before New York had legalized abortion as a state. Jessica, you make a distinction in your Atlantic article between a sprawling grassroots infrastructure of abortion access that exists in this country and a small underground that also exists below the grassroots. Can you elaborate on the difference between those two branches, the grassroots and the underground below it?
Yeah, absolutely. So because we are in a situation where only 90% of counties in the U.S. don't have abortion clinics. More than 1,300 state restrictions have come into play since Roe was decided. And the Hyde Amendment, every time the federal budget is signed, there's an amendment saying that you cannot use any federal Medicaid funding and other federal funds for abortion. So that targets low-income people. So there have been, for a very long time, areas of the country, many of them, where people will tell you that Roe might as well not be the law of the land already. And because of that, this sprawling grassroots infrastructure, I call it, has sprung up. One of the most important components of that is abortion funds. We've got more than 90 of them across the U.S., and they raise money to help people pay for procedures, for transportation, for lodging. They are always strapped for resources. I know that in 2019, even though they gave direct support to more than 55,000 people, that was just about a quarter of the calls that network received. Mm. So these people are already running in a really tenuous situation and just getting ready for a deluge of more people who are going to come asking for assistance if Roe falls.
Absolutely. And Brian, if I can just add to what Jessica is saying, I mean, what she's describing is really standing in the gap for some of these blue states where you have legislatures that have worked to codify protections and even in a few cases increase access. But in those states where abortion isn't really expected or to be heavily or almost completely restricted, if Roe is overturned, you have clinics that are worried about whether they have the capacity to provide abortions for everybody mm-hmm. who's trying to get one.
I think we have time for one more caller, Judy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Judy. You're on the program. Thank you for calling in.
Hi there. I was born in 1950 in Michigan, and in 1971, I was living in Detroit. I was involved in an unfortunate marriage, and I got pregnant, and I had never wanted children. And I was extraordinarily fortunate because the doctor who confirmed my pregnancy connected me with that network of clergy people who were helping women to access abortion. There's a law in Michigan on the books from 1931 that outlaws all abortions, which our governor now is working hard to try to get off the books, but in case Roe is overturned. But at any rate, I was able to go to New York City. This was November of 1971, and I had an abortion. I believe it was a Planned Parenthood on Lexington Avenue. I wound up living in New York City for many years after that. Mm-hmm. That was the first of two illegal abortions I had, the second in 72 when I was living in Oregon and wound up going to Seattle. I would like to say that, I'm extraordinarily grateful for the people who helped me at that time. I had never wanted children, never had children. I'm happy about that. And I also want to say that I know of a gynecologist here in Ann Arbor who is working with a group of other clinicians to try to help women here in Michigan in case the overturning of Roe does lead to a ban on legal abortions in Michigan. So
help
I think
help them
all help. Of this is relevant. And well, she didn't give me details about that. And I think there's a certain confidentiality there. But I did refer her to Jessica's article in The Atlantic. Thank you, Jessica, for that article. It's fantastic.
And Judy, thank you for your call. Well, we're almost out of time. You know, she mentioned Planned Parenthood. Erin, I'm curious what you see for Planned Parenthood as a role in a post-Roe world. It's been a central player in providing abortion services, of course. Does that change in a more medication-based telehealth environment?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've actually got a column coming out tomorrow talking about what some of these groups like Planned Parenthood are doing going forward. Planned Parenthood's part of a coalition of several groups that are planning about 370 actions across the country this weekend, right? Having these rallies for people who want to signal their support for abortion access. What they are saying now is that they are really focused on the political strategy to make sure that they have people at the local, state, and federal level to protect access to abortion, really trying to harness a lot of the momentum mm-hmm. that they have seen in the last 2 weeks and turn that protest into policy and power.
And with that, we conclude this hour on the past, present, and future of Illegal Abortion Underground with Erin Haynes, editor-at-large for the 19th, the news organization covering gender, politics, and policy, and Jessica Bruder, best known as author of Nomad Land, and now author of a major article in the May Atlantic about the past, present, and future called The Abortion Underground. Jessica and Erin, thank you very much for your time and your reporting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.